I think I was like barely 20 years old or 21. And I think, yeah, I then had the moment of my life. I felt like a thunderbolt, like bang on my head, because I was
cracking
like this.
You open and saying, totally, okay, this is it.
And I'm like, amazing. Why am I wasting time thinking about something else? This is the spot I want to be.
Herzlich willkommen hier beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Wir sind Julika und Tom. Und Tom, du hast ja in dieser Folge gesprochen mit der jungen Dirigentin Elim Chan. Ich hatte sie ein paar Tage vorher kennengelernt, für so einen sehr kurzen Social-Media-Aufsager nur haben wir sie hier getroffen. Und ich muss sagen, also die hat mich, ich war hin und weg. So eine sympathische, gewinnende, witzige Person, so viel Energie. Es hat mir echt Spaß gemacht, diese sehr kurze Begegnung. Ihr habt ja jetzt länger gesprochen.
Sie ist sehr besonders, sehr selbstbewusst, sie strahlt viel Freude aus, viel Spontaneität, viel Sensibilität. Ich war auch ziemlich verknallt von Anfang an eigentlich. Als ich sie auf dem Podium sah, fand ich sie schon irgendwie ganz ungewöhnlich.
Und du hast sie erst dirigieren sehen.
Ich habe sie erst dirigieren sehen und dann habe ich sehr spontan gesagt, ich würde wahnsinnig gerne diese Frau sprechen, weil das habe ich so oft, man sieht ja viele Dirigenten in der Elbphilharmonie, wenn man die Freude hat, hier zu arbeiten. Und es sind viele ganz tolle Leute dabei. Und dann gibt es manchmal dann noch irgendwie so ganz besondere Momente, wo man denkt, hey, was ist das denn? Wie kann das denn sein? Und man kennt das Orchester und man merkt, es ist jetzt das erste Mal, dass die mit ihr spielen, aber die fressen ihr aus der Hand. Das ist ja ganz erstaunlich. Und das war das erste Konzert mit denen. Und dann denkt man, hui.
Ziemlich phänomenal, ja.
War sie total nett und hat sich dann sofort dann irgendwie, am übernächsten Tag haben wir dann gesprochen, zwischen so Mittags- und Nachmittagskonzerten, die sie hier hatte.
Sie ist in Hongkong geboren, überwiegend ausgebildet in den USA. Ihr habt ja auch, das hatte sie auch bei uns schon für den Teaser kurz angedeutet, über ihren Werdegang gesprochen, der ja, glaube ich, auch einige ganz witzige Anekdoten bereithält. Ich fand es aber besonders schön, dass ihr in eurem Gespräch so ausführlich auch darüber geredet habt, was es eigentlich heißt, Dirigentin zu sein, weil man ja eben nicht nur dieses sehr große musikalische Know-how braucht, einen guten Überblick über die Partitur, sondern eben auch dieses menschliche Gespür dafür, was braucht es eigentlich, so eine große Gruppe mitzunehmen und zu führen. Und ich hatte das Gefühl, da ist sie wirklich wahnsinnig selbstbewusst und eben, wie ich gesagt habe, echt gewinnend auch, oder?
Ja, bei ihr kommen die Sachen, glaube ich, auf eine sehr gute Art zusammen. Sie ist natürlich wahrscheinlich mega gut vorbereitet auf die Dinge und kennt die Stücke wirklich so gut es nur irgendwie geht, so gut sie es auch nur vorbereiten kann.
Ja, ich finde es echt schade, dass ich das Konzert verpasst habe. Ich habe nur kurz die Probe gesehen. Aber sie kommt ja zum Glück jetzt im August, also im Elbphilharmonie Sommer, schon das nächste Mal wieder mit dem Konzertgebau Orchest Young und der Cellistin Julia Hagen, die bringen so Knallerwerke wie Schostakowitsch 5 oder Elgas Cellokonzert. Und ich denke auch, danach wird sie sicher regelmäßig hier auftauchen. Denn
ja, weil das muss man wahrscheinlich noch sagen, wenn wir jetzt ja selber hören, auch in dem Gespräch. Das wäre jetzt zu wenig zu sagen, sie ist jetzt die große tolle Metaphysikerin und sie dirigiert mit 30 jetzt schon so wie Claudia Abbado an seinem Lebensende. Das stimmt nicht. Das ist schon, da ist auch eine ganz große Entschiedenheit in ihr und eine ganz große Power, sonst könnte sie eben diese Brocken da Schostakowitsch und so wahrscheinlich gar nicht so vielgestaltig dirigieren. Und das ist eben genauso faszinierend, dass sie eben wirklich das ganze Spektrum irgendwie auffächern kann. Und ich glaube, die Orchester, die sie eingeladen haben, die können es kaum erwarten, dass sie wiederkommt.
Das glaube ich auch. Also
Alena sieht ziemlich gut aus bei ihr und da sind einige Dinge wohl auch noch jetzt im Schwange, die jetzt drohen oder im besten Sinne auf sie zukommen werden. Also noch weitere große Orchesterdebüts und so. Konnte sie noch nicht drüber sprechen, aber war sie schon ganz heiß drauf.
Behalten wir im Blick.
Ja, auf jeden Fall.
Damit viel Spaß beim Hören.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
I'm sitting here with Elim Chan and I'm super excited that this really worked. Because just, I think 2 days ago, to be very honest, I hadn't really heard of you. Which is a shame because you have been performing in our hall so much already. So thank you, first of all, that you take the time to talk to me now, Elim.
Thank you for having me.
I saw you perform with the NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchestra and that was a contemporary piece the program began with. Very, very little happening, actually, in the beginning.
Mm.
But I was mesmerized right from the start, because you have a way of creating the silent space that was almost like a Tai Chi moment for me. Do you practice Tai Chi?
I don't, but I'm very aware of the idea of Qi, which is, I think, for music and for conducting, actually. I think maybe in that sense, a different word for it will be the core. This energy you have within, And
she's being translated as life force, like absolutely. The invisible, like the prana, the Sanskrit people would say.
Yes. And actually with this piece, the first time when I, you know, rehearsed with the orchestra, of course, the first time everyone was like understanding what is happening, and there were many playfulness, maybe too much, you know, people are just trying to understand, you know, what she was, the composer is trying to ask them to do. And after all that, I said, okay, let's go back and really, you know, understand what is the image or the vision. And I told them, you know, the composer was really thinking of setting up this scene of like a mother holding her child sitting in, you know, a very simple, maybe apartment made of wood. And then you hear the rain started to drop on the ceiling, and you hear the tuk, 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 and you hear the rain and the wind. And I said, rain and wind never just start like bap and ends like bap like this. You know, it's
a continuous motion.
It's, exactly. It's horizontal. It's layers of humidity that you need to feel. And I said, can we create this inside Elb Germany now? And everyone's eyes were like, oh, and then we try again. And it was completely like, you know, on its way to what you have heard two nights
fantastic,
ago.
Fantastic, fantastic. And it's so beautiful that you talk about chi, because I think this is so crucial in, as you said in the beginning, for music in general, you know, because it's a form of energy. It's sound, it's airwaves moving, you know, in different forms and speeds and stuff. And to see this, I've rarely seen this ever a conductor do, I must honestly say. You know, of course you can be very present in the silence or in the little happening, but it was so formed and so, the gestalt, as you would say, was so palpable that I was totally transfixed right from the start.
Oh,
And then you kept doing wonderful things with the orchestra, you know. You conducted this Haydn in a very small, beautiful arrangement with this wonderful Stephen Isserlis, mm-hmm. and then Slavsky Concerto for Orchestra. It was all really, really, really strong. And I figured, why haven't I heard you before? Why? What took me so long, you know?
Oh, well, I mean, now we met.
Now we met. And it is kind of love at first sight, really, and this really happens. And it was really, of course, and I read about you. I've seen some interviews you gave, and you say this happens so often. You come to an orchestra which is new to you, like the NDR in this case. And then you say this beautiful three words, you know, I'm Asian, I'm a woman, I'm petite, and everybody is maybe, oh, what's she up to here? What does she want? And I was wondering, do you always notice the moment where it changes, where the musicians realize, oh, this girl has something to watch out for, and that the respect, you know, ultimately comes?
Well, first of all, those three characteristics, when you put them all together, exactly, it created this sort of people's eyes were like, oh, like, what do we expect? What can we expect? Probably not much, right? And I love this sort of, oh, when you have such low expectations, that's when, because the bar cannot go so lower. And then that's when I think things can start. That's when I can break the box. I can break the expectations. And going back to the idea of chi, I'm very aware of people's energies. I mean, we have like 80 to 100 people in the room. Everyone brings in his or her different, you know, energies. And it can be great or bad. You know, it can be just like people even like coming in, running in late.
Condition of the day. Yeah.
Or like people having just a nice coffee, like a sunny day. We have an hour right now. And then, you know, they come into rehearsal. And I'm trying to like focus all of them and let's do something together. And I'm very fascinated by, you know, how do I create that space? Actually, it starts from me. And for example, with this Japanese piece that we talked about, I have to be the one who immediately set the tone. No, this is what she's trying to create, and let's take this, you know. And when I'm really have, in that sense, a strong chi or the strong sort of the vision.
This radiates in a way.
Exactly. And I invite them to come into this. It's like, you know, let's come into my house. And then we do this together. And that's when I notice, of course, myself, like the change of, like, you know, I see their faces. I feel their playing changed. And usually sometimes words are not, you don't need many words. You only need a gaze, a certain gesture, in a certain hearing, listening. And then you look at the certain people and like, no, now you. Nope. And then suddenly the focus comes in and things starts to happen. And I love that.
Fabulous. You said in an interview that you knew by the age of 8 that you wanted to become a conductor. And it happened apparently when you were watching a woman conducting in the TV, I guess, or maybe in the concert. Who was it? Who was that woman?
It was a live concert, and it's the school's concert where, like, you know, I went with all my classmates in a school bus, and the conductor would basically do a lot of excerpts from these famous pieces, right? And then they would explain, like, these are the strings, these are the woodwinds, these are the brass.
Like an educational situation.
Yes, yeah. And then I have to fill in this form, you know, what did I learn? And it was in Hong Kong, you know, where I grew up. The Hong Kong Philharmonic, and the conductor, her name was Yip Wing Si, and she was at the time, I think, resident conductor of the orchestra. So when she entered the stage, you know, it was so, in that sense, never a problem. I didn't like, oh, it was a woman. You know, it was just like, wow, she looks cool, and she got on stage, and then she made all these sounds happen. You know, it was like Rite of Spring, it was like Tchaikovsky, you know, the pizzicato movement from Fourth Symphony. I was just, you know, thinking, I want to be like her, I want to be where she is, because I thought she's a magician. Yeah.
Did you ever tell her how instrumental she was in your career?
I don't think I've ever told her in her face, but then, you know, and then later on I picked up the cello, I played in the youth orchestra, and she came in to conduct as well. And of course I was just like, oh my God, you know.
Your role model.
Yeah. And of course at the time I had no idea how to become a conductor, because it's such a mysterious, elusive career, no? And everyone tells you, you need to know everything about the orchestra, you need to know all the instruments. And I was like, how do I know that? And then I even, you know, took a detour, because then I love other things as well. I loved psychology. I thought, you know, I would become a spy. And, you know, I studied everything else. Yes. And, you know, and then I came back to music. But I've always remembered, you know, it was never a question of what gender you are in, because that was what I saw. And then, you know, I just wanted to.
You had the confidence right from the start that that would be probably the way orchestras would be conducted, like, forever. That was your first experience.
So. Absolutely.
You said you then started playing cello, meaning you. What kind of musical formation did you have before? Did you do some Suzuki violin stuff, or what was the primary musical education you came up with?
Yeah. So actually, I started. Well, first of all, I came from a non-musical family. But my parents were really open, you know, they thought, oh, okay, Elim likes the piano. So I started piano lessons at 6 years old. And I also was in a children's choir for basically, I think, as long as I could remember, you know, as a child, as a young girl, as a woman, and I've always sung in choirs, which I, you know, really think it's a big contribution to understanding or just, you know, being in a group and doing music together. I think that's sort of like having a glimpse of something bigger than yourself. I think this idea.
And knowing that there are voices that are necessary but not your own.
Exactly, yes. And listening.
To create the whole.
Yeah, and social, the social aspect of creating something together. And you need to work on, you know, like sometimes, you know, I'm not the main focus, right? Someone else has the main line. So this whole idea since I was young, you know, it started. So cello would be, you know, basically the last sort of cherry on the cake, you know, because I was like, okay, I was in choir and I played the piano, but I wanted to have the experience feeling, like, how does it feel to be in an orchestra? And so I picked up the cello when I was around like 11, 12 years old, you know, just to play. And then I never wanted to become a soloist. That I knew from very early on. Also with piano, I knew. It's like I love music, but I don't like to be alone on stage. And now you see, I have
to. You kind of chose the opposite, so. You are, in a way, you are very alone.
Yes.
Other than the baton, and sometimes even not the baton, you don't have anything.
Exactly.
But your chi and your energy and your knowledge and your persuasiveness and all this. And then the orchestra is becoming your instrument, of course, as everybody who conducts would probably agree. So then you somehow must have decided still quite early on, this needs to be like trained and learned. So you went to the US. Did you go with your parents? Did you go by yourself?
Myself.
By yourself? At the age of?
18.
18.
Yeah. So I left Hong Kong. And of course, at the time, I had other dreams.
Tell me more about these other dreams.
Yeah. So I mentioned, like, because I love psychology. I loved detective stories. I mean, like, who doesn't love Sherlock Holmes? Who doesn't love, you know, Agatha Christie?
All these, Poirot, yeah.
Yes. And like, FBI things, you know. So I CSI, all these shows, I was like, oh, you know. And so I've always just like been fascinated even by people in general, like human beings.
Behavior.
So I, even though I also love music, I thought I wanted to study psychology, maybe even, you know, go into medicine. I have other things I want to try. So I went to America and I left Hong Kong when I was 18, went to America and, you know, basically started my bachelor's in all sorts of different subjects. But I kept going to choir practice. And that's when it's my link with music. You know, I felt like music never really let me loose, you know. It keeps on knocking the door. So when I auditioned for the choir, the conductor said, oh, Ilim, you have good ears. Why not be my assistant? I wouldn't understand what that means. I was 18, but okay, sure.
Right from the start,
Yeah. And actually, if I have to go back a bit more, I told you I was singing in a children's choir and then in a girls' choir. Actually, the first time I've ever conducted, I was, I think, 12 or 13 years old. Again, it was like one day my choir teacher just came to me and said, Ilim, I want you to conduct. Can you imagine my face? I was like,
of course.
Conduct, like, you mean like you? And she's like, yes, you just, you know, take the choir and you conduct. I was like, how? Well, you figure it out.
Amazing.
So I, you know, I conducted the choir, but, you know, I never understand what did I do, of course. And then again, when I was, you know, 18 in America, conductor said, you should be an assistant. You know what? You should conduct a piece in the first concert in the autumn. Okay. And how to do it? Well, you just figure it out. You know, and I did it. And after that piece, I think that evening, the whole music department was like on fire. They were like, Ilim, you really need to do this. You know, and I was like, well, you know, I came to America thinking psychology,
spying.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, really? Like, I mean, of course, I've always been interested in the conducting journey or like this job or however we want to call it. So of course I was like, okay, but how, right? And then they said, okay, you know what? You should conduct more, right? Then the next thing I had a chance to do the Verdi's Requiem. Just a little bit because the conducting teacher at the time, you know, was like, okay, you prepare the Dies Irae. And I conduct a bit and then he would go out and listen for the balance. So I'm like, okay, no. And of course, Dies Irae from the Verdi's Requiem is one of these just most iconic, powerful moments in classical music. And of course, I started and that was like the first time I've stood in front of an orchestra plus chorus plus brass, like, you know, offstage standing, whatever. And of course, my teacher thought Ilim would just conduct through some stuff and he, you know, then can fix things. But I don't know, I felt something possessed me. And I started fixing. I was like, bass drum, we need more of this. Strings, we need like, you. I started rehearsing because I don't know, I was not satisfied with what I was hearing. And I think I was like barely 20 years old or 21. And I think, yeah, and then I had the moment of my life. I felt like a thunderbolt, like bang on my head because I was
cracking
like
you open and saying, total, okay, this is it.
Ilim, like,
amazing.
Why am I wasting time thinking about something else? This is the spot I want to be.
What did the conductor's response was?
Well,
when he or she came back?
He came back and he's like, I think off you go. You should really take this seriously now.
So he was supportive.
Yes. And then I put the music into the, you know, this is what I need now.
Away from the back burner, exactly. Right in front of.
Exactly. Turn to the foreground. Yeah. You know, now study all the like, theory, harmony, you know, like, and prepare to go to study conducting because, of course, to study conducting is not easy. You can't do it in bachelor's. It's really in the master's level. And then it, you know, I do all these auditions and then got into a great program. That was, you know, good 10 years in America doing all this.
Fabulous.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Cinderella story happened when this was 2014. After, you know, at the end of my American years, I thought, okay, you know, now let's see where I am compared to everyone else in the world. And I literally was like, that was my first competition. Oh, it's a Donatella Flick LSO conducting competition. And I just put in my name and then you put in some tapes and it was very lucky.
Yeah. So you made it in the first prize.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And then everything, the rest is history.
And Luzern and Bernard Haitink happened shortly after?
Exactly, 2015.
15 already. Yeah.
And that also was life-changing. And even
tell
now,
tell me a bit about. I mean, we have heard him once here before he passed away. He was conducting Brahms' Deutsches Requiem, I think, in 2018 or so. with the Symphonieorchester des Bayerischen Rundfunks. Marvelous. And then
so with Bernard, he always had this conducting masterclass during the Easter Lucerne Festival. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky I got into the, you know, because there's still a little audition when you arrive, who would become the main participants and who would become the auditors. Mm-hmm. So I was really lucky I got into the main, as one of the main people. And there is a story because I always thought, oh, I was so angry at him, what he did to me. But I loved him, of course.
What stirred your anger?
So on the list of the masterclass, of, you know, the repertoire, there was Bruckner's Sixth Symphony, which is, of course, one of his specialty. And on the list, it only says first movement. So we all prepared the first movement and he taught it. But one of the days, right before lunch break, he said, I want all of you to look at the second movement and I will pick one of you to conduct this after lunch. I want the orchestra to play something, you know, different for them to feel, to be refreshed. And of course, you know, the few of the participants, we were like, no, lunchtime is what, like half an hour, 40 minutes. And it's a slow movement of Bruckner. It's like one of these most difficult things. So I remember I just like bought a bread. And then just like, you know, because we were all studying something else. We never thought this would happen. Okay, we all came back. He actually chose someone else, not me. So we were all like, oh, thank God. You know, and then, you know, the class went on as usual until the last day when it's like a sort of presentation of the class, and he assigned each of us to conduct something, and I got Bruckner 6, the first movement, which is originally what on the list, right? And I got the biggest orchestration and I would go on the last, and with audience it's open, you mm-hmm. know mm-hmm. So of course when it's my turn, I walk on the stage and was like ready, thinking dun, 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 you know, like ready, the cheers like getting there for the Bruckner 6. And then I was about to start and Haitian came up to me, tap on my back and said, Ilim, I'm so sorry to tell you something that you are not going to be very happy about. And I looked at him, yes, but because I'm going to tell you to conduct the second movement. Could you imagine my face? Mm-hmm. Could you imagine my chi? Mm-hmm. And then the orchestra.
Also, your rapport with the orchestra. Of course.
I mean, the orchestra, of course, they were like, oh, they were also all shocked. I wanted to, of course, debate, but you don't debate with Mr. Bernard Haitink, right? So Bernard just said, go ahead. And then he just went back and sit down and looked at me like, mm-hmm.
Wait for you to start.
Yep. I just turned to the orchestra and they said, we will help you. I'm like, oh, see you on the other side. I was so angry. I was like, why do this to me? Everyone else did their thing. And then why me? You have to shock me. Okay. Did it. He stopped me twice. He said, like, maybe listen to this one. Look at the baseline. Where is this is all going? Okay. He gave me two advice. And then by the end of it, he came back and he said, Ilim, when you conduct, you make me listen.
Mm.
I wanted to cry, but of course I was still so angry. Can you imagine? But that was the beginning of Bernard. And
so he must have been like a hell of a good pedagogue, because he was just challenging you so hard into something that really made you grow so much, you know?
Absolutely.
That was a maturity test or something.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, after
wonderful
that...
Wonderful story, yeah. By the way.
I mean, yeah, and he must have known that I could do it. And of course, this is similar to the stories I told you.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had these people who come to me and say, Ilim, I want you to conduct, before I even knew what I could do. But of course, this one with Bernard is really what put me, you know.
And you stayed in touch, apparently.
Yes, because then I became the assistant of the LSO. And then he was very close to the LSO and I was assisting him. And of course, then learned much more about, you know, basically like, you know, we did Mahler, the Brahms and more Bruckner. You know, looking back, I really cherished that time
mm-hmm,
with him.
Mm-hmm. So you have been performing in this hall quite a bit with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, mm-hmm. with Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie, now yes. with the NDR. You will be coming back in the summertime with
yes.
the Konzertgebouw Young,
yes.
which is quite exciting. And mm-hmm. this is very popular. I mean, the summer concerts here are really something very special, because everybody's coming, you know, and they have the summer leisure and they are very, really open and excited that the season is about to start again soon. And
yes.
I was wondering, which other big, beautiful orchestra plans do you have in the near future?
Ooh. Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, I used to have like a bucket list.
Mm-hmm.
I need to, you know, by this year, if
Berlin
I can
Philharmonic.
Get yeah, exactly.
Chicago.
Yeah, like these things, right? And the ones that you just said is going to happen.
Cool.
So it's like, oh my God. But then I think, you know, funny enough, after COVID, I almost tear the bucket list idea, because I think COVID really sort of made everything, I mean, it surprised us, right? It surprised our field. And I just really, I think coming out of COVID, I really just want to enjoy, we want to seize this, you know, opportunity that we can
celebrate, that we can be together,
yes,
again.
Right? And to, and also I think it gave me such an, how to say it, like a injection of, mm-hmm. of purpose. There's this urgency. I want the audience, when they're in the hall with me, I want them to feel something.
Would you say that it's even more than about the audience than it used to be about you?
I think so. I think especially this relationship with, like, you know, I think because that's what we missed during COVID, right? When we made these recordings, when you take away the live audiences, I mean, yes, we can go crazy with the recording. We can say, no, let's play it again because we need to make that note perfect. Like the last note, we didn't end together.
Take 15.
But then, you know, I remember leaving the hall, we all felt awkward, sad. Like the energy didn't go anywhere. We worked so hard, but no one received them. And no one give you back the energy. And that's why I was like, okay, now we get to do this again. And we do it now. You know, you see so many people coming and full halls again. Come on. This is, you know, it's like the triangle of energies. They need to, and when I have them now, you know, I want to give them something. Let that be joy, let that be shock, let that be questions, confusion, please feel something, you know?
Cool.
And so with this bucket list idea, I was like, you know, like I just almost don't care. I just want to feel alive and make people feel in those 2 hours, you are here. And I don't want them to think about, you know, whatever life is bothering them. But of course, you know, big plans that, you know, I'm you know, making, of course, special friendships with certain orchestras. So I'm going back to the Staatskapelle Berlin. You know, I do the Music Fest Berlin in the coming year. And of course, there's something big coming, which I cannot say yet for the summer before I come back to the Elbphilharmonie. And well, but I'm also looking forward to do this. They call it the SAIL Amsterdam, which is this big, open air concert with the Concertgebouw Young. I think it's with all the ships when they all convene.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Like Hafengeburtstag in Hamburg.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I think this only happens every 5 years or something. So I think that would be quite a scene to see and experience. I will also embark on opera, which is something I haven't had the time yet to do. So that is a very,
What will be your first opera then that you're going to conduct?
I would do the Bluebeard Castle, just to start. I mean, it's also, like, I love big orchestra, but like that piece is very special. Very special thing.
Talk. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And from there, you know,
And it's a Django opera. I mean, it's just two singers and then you have this orchestra and this eerie music sometimes and this eerie story.
Yes, totally. So I, you know, want to start with that, and then also I'm doing more pieces with singers, and that is something I'm very excited about, because, you know, I'm like sort of reconnecting back to my
own
the voices.
Yeah.
And so yeah, many good things are coming.
That sounds all very fantastic. Before I let you go, just tell me about the spy thing. You said you were just imagining to become a spy. What was that?
I mean, I love mysteries. I love solving mysteries. And when you read a good, like, detective novel, you get sort of, you know, taken on this journey, and you pick on clues, right? You see how they unfold, and sometimes you think, this is it, right? This is it. No! And then there's a big sort of a surprise or plot twist. And then you see, like, how then, like, you need to find more clues. And in the end, you know, you find the truth or, like, what happened. I always find this very close to when the conductor, like, you study a score.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to point out.
You can't talk to the composer. The composer is dead.
You're an intermediate between.
Exactly. And then you see the score. Those are the clues. And you try to
recreate. The only thing is, it's not enemies. It should be allies. You are.
Exactly.
You're trying to reconcile.
Exactly. And then don't destroy the clues.
Yeah.
And make something completely different. And so I find the process fascinating. And it never ends. You can go down the rabbit hole and get so nerdy and find, you know, and still, I think even the same piece over time, over the years, it tells you different things. It tells you more things. It tells you deeper things, right?
Do you use the same score that you've been using maybe 5 years ago, or do you get a new one?
I get a new one, but I never throw the one away, because I have, like, you know, precious notes. before. And
but you don't copy those precious notes, or do you?
I try to do it again, all mm-hmm. over again. And of course, it sort of get distilled over the years. I mean, I used to have like rainbow colors on my score. I
think
Beethoven 5 was like, whoa.
So many things to point out to and to be aware of.
Yeah, now pencil and red and blue.
Ilim, it was really a sheer joy talking to you and listening to you. Thank you so much.
Thank
I will escort
me.
You to your dressing room because you will be performing.
I know.
Not too far from now.
Get into action.
Yes. Thank you, Tom.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche mehr verpassen willst, abonnier uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Leisthalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.
Viva la Podcast. Podcasten muss sich wieder lohnen.
Wir bieten dir kostenloses Podcast-Hosting ohne Limitierungen.
Du kümmerst dich ums Podcasten.
Und wir kümmern uns um den Rest.
Und das Beste daran, du verdienst auch noch Geld. Ab dem ersten Hörer.
Der ersten Hörerin. Besuche uns auf kostenlos-hosten.de und informiere dich.
Teure Hostingkosten müssen nicht sein. kostenlos-hosten.de Die Podcast Re-Evolution.